Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize the increasing tensions on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea has fired not one, but two intercontinental ballistic missiles that startled the West. Many people didn't believe that North Korea could do this for perhaps another 10 years, and already it's launched two successful ICBM launches. And what did the United States do? It launched its own ICBM from California, and perhaps there's no coincidence that this launch took place right after the launch of the North Korean missiles. And then in a candid discussion with President Donald Trump, he would not exclude the possibility of war. That's right, war. He said that his duty, of course, is to protect the people of the United States, not necessarily the people of North Korea. And it means that, well, if the North Koreans have the capability of dropping hydrogen bombs on the U.S. of A., that's in some sense a red line, and crossing it perhaps means war. And so, of course, the United States wants to negotiate, but it does mean that tensions are ratcheting up several layers as a consequence. And what about China? China's point of view has always been that, well, they're like a referee. They're looking at it from the sidelines. They don't take positions on the question. But hey, come on, give me a break. The Chinese could be the key to this whole puzzle as to how to wind down all the tensions that are now engulfing the Korean Peninsula. And also news about commercial nuclear power. It turns out that not one, but two major South Carolina reactors are going to be abandoned. It turns out it's a $9 billion loss to the utilities. The reactors are only 40% finished, and the VC Summer nuclear station will never be built. The owners of the plant have thrown in the towel. They're saying that the economics, the physical plant, and simply things are not ready to begin the completion of the nuclear power plant, which could cost billions more, up to $25 billion, perhaps double the original estimate of $11.5 billion. So in other words, the utilities are perhaps cutting their losses. And the question is this the beginning of the end for commercial nuclear power? We were supposed to be entering a nuclear renaissance. Remember that? A nuclear renaissance that would save us from the greenhouse effect. Well, it turns out that a lot of the major utilities are essentially throwing in the towel when it comes to commercial nuclear power, and only two plants in Georgia are now being planned. So much for the renaissance. And also a new breakthrough, it turns out, in genetic engineering. It turns out the scientists were able to actually manipulate the genes of an embryo that hasn't even been born yet. I mean, think about this. This means that germline gene therapy may be a real possibility. Designer children? Well, we don't have them yet. But it may be possible, not just for one generation, but think about that, to change your entire genetic heritage. On one hand, that means eliminating lethal genes that have plagued our gene pool and our family line for generations. On the other hand, it means tinkering with the genetic heritage of the human race, which make people very afraid. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today is that North Korea has fired not one, but two intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the United States, not to be outdone, fired its own test ICBM with a dummy nuclear warhead from California. And so we're now seeing a test of wills. Well, it turns out that a more detailed analysis of the latest ICBM launch shows that the missile probably broke up on reentry. This is really important, because what's the point of shooting a hydrogen bomb thousands of miles across the surface of the Earth, only to have the bomb break up in the final seconds of the trajectory? So apparently the North Koreans still have not yet solved the problem of reentry. And that's why the trajectory of the missile has been so strange. instead of shooting the missile, let's say, at a 45-degree angle, which would maximize the range of the missile, the North Koreans have been firing their missiles almost vertically up, and they come vertically down. Well, on one hand, it looks as if the North Koreans are playing with us, but there are actually several reasons for doing this. First of all, if you fire the intercontinental ballistic missile more or less horizontally, you don't know where it's going to land, and it may land on a neutral territory and, of course, cause an international crisis as a consequence. So better to shoot it up and have it come down, even if the range is limited. Because, of course, the trajectory can be modified at will. But that's also another reason. You see, if you fire it straight up and the missile comes straight down, the velocity of reentry is at a maximum. So the North Koreans want to test their nose cone, they want to test their heat shield, they want to test their hydrogen bombs to see whether or not they can withstand the pressures, the vibrations, and of course the heat upon reentry. And that's another reason for basically shooting their missiles almost vertically up and having them come vertically down. Well, when will the North Koreans actually have the capability of A, miniaturizing a nuclear warhead to be placed inside the missile, and B, having it reliably land on the continental United States rather than having it break up? Well, no one knows, but now people are saying that perhaps before the end of this decade, we come to the Rubicon. And the question is, well, what will Donald Trump do at that point? Donald Trump has pretty much stated that it is unacceptable for the North Koreans to have the capability of placing a hydrogen bomb on the continental U.S. of A. In so many words, that's the red line that he is drawing in the sand. And recently, he had a candid conversation with a politician, and he laid out the fact that, yes, it could mean war. Yes, the United States is not afraid, he said, of the potential of actually going to war if the North Koreans attain the capability of dropping hydrogen bombs, let's say, on the west coast of USA reliably. He said, more or less, that the duty of the government is to protect the people of the United States. Yes, we want to save as many lives in Asia as possible, but the primary responsibility is to protect the people of the U.S. of A. So in order to understand this chess game between North Korea, China, and the United States, let's break it down from each of their points of view. The point of view of the United States is, as I mentioned, it is unacceptable for the North Koreans with this erratic government to be able to place a hydrogen bomb on the continental U.S. of A. Right now, in principle, they could probably hit Los Angeles, something that they were not supposed to be able to do for another decade. But yes, now it does appear as if they could perhaps drop a hydrogen bomb on Los Angeles, not reliably, of course, not with great accuracy. And of course, the missile may break up on reentry, but in principle, they could do it. Now, so the U.S. point of view is that there is an unofficial red line. However, now look at it from the North Korean point of view. The North Korean point of view is that they fear regime change. They saw what happened to Saddam Hussein. They saw what happened to Gaddafi. They did not have nuclear weapons, and what happened to them? They're both dead now. And so they see nuclear weapons as their guarantee for survival. Not to mention the fact that, well, who has hydrogen bombs? It's basically the United States, not the North Koreans. And for that matter, who's conducting tests of a potential invasion of the other country? It is the United States and South Korea which regularly performs these massive military exercises. Now, what about the military point of view? How do the generals view it? The generals see a worst-case scenario as being a real mess. First of all, Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is within artillery range of North Korea. That's right. The demilitarized zone is one of the most heavily fortified lines on the planet Earth. And it turns out that the capital of South Korea is very close to the demilitarized zone, meaning that an artillery barrage within minutes could be launched, which will level most of the capital of South Korea. Not to mention the fact that if it requires an invasion, then it takes months to schedule an invasion of the North if it comes to that. And so the military generals that have looked at the whole situation realize it's a mess. And of course, you don't know how many atomic bombs that North Korea has. You don't know what their capability is in terms of annihilating South Korea and parts of Japan. And so it's a huge wild card from the military point of view with no guarantee of success. Now, the South Korean government has plans to decapitate, that is, a surgical strike on the leadership of North Korea. Well, yes, South Korea is advanced. They have the capability of a surgical strike. But the question always is, what happens if one, just one atomic bomb manages to evade the decapitating strike? And what happens if that one atomic bomb lands on the capital of Japan or the capital of South Korea? That's well within the capability of the North Koreans. So how do we get out of this mess? Well, one way is to put pressure on China, which is what Donald Trump is trying to do without much success. Look at it from the Chinese point of view. At first, you may say to yourself that the Chinese have everything to gain and nothing to lose by reining in North Korea. However, it's more complicated than that. You see, what China really wants is a buffer between it and the United States. Let's say that the North Korean government collapses, either economically, politically, or militarily. Who's going to take over in the vacuum? In the vacuum, well, A, many North Koreans will flee into China, creating a tremendous immigration problem. B, South Korea will probably invade or take over North Korea. And behind them come U.S. troops. So in other words, if the North Korean government collapses from the point of view of China, it means that American troops will be stationed right next to the border of China. And that's what the Chinese don't want. In fact, they would rather tolerate a nuclear erratic dictatorship in North Korea than have U.S. troops right on its border. And so how do we get out of this mess? Well, all three sides have stated that they are open to negotiations. However, exactly what the terms of the negotiation are is unclear. But take a look at what each side wants. What North Korea wants is a guarantee of survival. That's the bottom line. No ifs, ands, or buts. They've seen what happened to other dictatorships. Dictators have no retirement policy. Dictators go out usually in a coffin. There's no pension plan for dictators. And so as far as a North Korean dictatorship is concerned, it's all or nothing. It's survival or being taken out in a coffin. And that means that what each side wants is a little bit different. What the United States wants is a denuclearized North Korea. That may or may not be on the table. What North Korea wants is they want the guarantee of survival. And what China wants is a buffer. And so you see that even if we negotiate, it's going to be complicated. Well, let's hope that cooler heads prevail. But right now, let's be blunt about it, there is talk of war. And if it comes to war, we're talking about thousands, if not millions of lives at stake. So let's hope that, quote, cooler heads prevail and that we find some common ground between three very divergent agendas. And speaking about agendas, nuclear power is apparently on the ropes. Remember the nuclear renaissance? The nuclear renaissance was supposed to be the resurgence in the fortunes of commercial nuclear power because of the fact that we have, well, global warming and we have an energy crisis. Well, many things have happened. First of all, yes, we have the greenhouse effect, but many people are saying that in order to make a dent, for nuclear to make a dent on the greenhouse effect, we would have to increase our commitment to nuclear by 5-10 times, which is simply not going to happen. And so, in other words, the white knight of nuclear power, this nuclear renaissance, is probably not going to happen for very practical reasons. Now we have a body blow dealt to commercial nuclear power because of the fact that in South Carolina, we have two major nuclear power plants backed by South Carolina Electric and Gas and the Santee Cooper Corporation that have thrown in the towel. That's right. They have sunk $2.2 billion. That's right. They have sunk, get this, $9 billion on these lemons. $9 billion for the VC Summer Nuclear Station, two of them in South Carolina. They are only 40% finished. However, to finish them would require a total cost of $25 billion. That's more than twice the original $11.5 billion price tag of the reactors. In other words, the utilities are suffering from sticker shock. Costs have ballooned. Demand has shrunk. And as a consequence, they have thrown in the towel. It's only 40% finished, and that's it, folks. It's never going to be finished. And of course, it's even worse than this. The company that is building the plant is Westinghouse. The reactors are the AP1000s. And who owns Westinghouse? Well, Toshiba of Japan. And Toshiba of Japan is saying that they cannot sustain these enormous losses because of Westinghouse, and Westinghouse is bankrupt. So think about this. Two utilities have thrown in the towel and are writing off, essentially writing off $15 billion off the books by saying that better to cut your losses rather than lose $20 billion in the future. Meanwhile, Toshiba, the owner of Westinghouse, which builds the AP1000, they are bankrupt. That is, Westinghouse that cannot pay. In fact, Toshiba has agreed to pay $2.2 billion to get out of the contract because Westinghouse has gone bankrupt. And of course, that is not enough to pay for the $9 billion that have been spent so far. And so then the question is, what happened? What happened? Well, several things happened all at once. First of all, we have the rather dramatic drop in the cost of oil and natural gas. Second of all, we have the rising fortunes of solar and wind power, which are within striking distance of being competitive with coal. We also have the political aftershocks of the Fukushima disaster, problem after problem after problem. So what went wrong? Well, some people point the finger at what happened 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the foundation for commercial nuclear power was laid because the Nautilus, a nuclear submarine, sailed underneath the North Pole, dazzling the people of the world. People were amazed that this light water Nautilus reactor could sail underneath the North Pole, making headlines. And then people said, well, if the Nautilus can do it, why not simply scale it up? Well, instead of doing the basic nuclear research on different reactor designs, they simply said, well, here's a proven design, light water reactors. They simply scaled it up. They didn't look at other kinds of designs, for example, molten salt coolant systems or gas cooling or using pellets or any number of different kinds of designs using gas cooling, using sodium, rather than the light water design based on uranium rather than, for example, thorium. So we were hooked on light water uranium nuclear power plants, basically scaling them up from the tiny Nautilus reactor to the gigantic 1,000-megawatt reactors of today. Well, they became increasingly complex as a consequence, so complex that engineers couldn't keep track of all the safety issues involved. You have so many moving parts, so many valves, so many pumps, and one valve going haywire caused the Three Mile Island accident. That's right, it was just one valve, one PORV, the pressure-operated relief valve, remained in the stuck position, but the control panel said it was closed. Well, the control operators did what common sense says, obey what the control panel says, which says the valve is closed. Well, the valve was stuck. It stuck in the open position, and it bled out about 1 million gallons of cooling water, creating the biggest American nuclear power accident. Think about that. A part that probably only cost a few dollars created the $1 billion loss of Three Mile Island in 1979. And then in 1986, we have an even worse accident. The Russians were making a routine test of the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl, and there was a transient, a power surge, but because they were making repairs, their safety systems were turned off. That was the wrong time to have a power surge, because when your safety systems are turned off, the reactor spins out of control without a brake. So think of repairing your car, for example. The car has a brake. But think of disengaging the brake because you want to make repairs, and all of a sudden, the car lurches forward by accident. Well, without brakes, the car simply takes off on its own. And that's what we call the Chernobyl nuclear power plant accident. And then just a few years ago, we had an even bigger accident in terms of melted fuel, and that's the Fukushima disaster. Three, not one, three reactors simultaneously melted. In fact, the configuration of the uranium is basically unknown. For the first time, just a few weeks ago, after months of agonizing over what to do, a submarine was sent into the water at Fukushima, giving us the first grainy pictures of the melted uranium. That's how difficult it is to fix three melted nuclear power plants that suffered 100% liquefaction of the cores. We'd never seen this before. We've never seen a complete liquefaction of a core, not to mention three of them, and we don't know what to do about it. It turns out that it may take 40 years. I repeat, it may take 40 years to clean up the mess at Fukushima. And so you can see, given all these piled up problems, you can see the reason why nuclear power is not the white knight, that the nuclear renaissance is not going to save us from the greenhouse effect. And you can see the enormous problems facing us even today. So some people are saying that, well, nuclear power is in some sense an unfinished technology. It's not finished. We have all this nuclear waste piling up. We don't know what to do with it. Not to mention the fact that we still have the cleanup operation at Fukushima. The military, that is the Pentagon, tried to have a contest to create a robot which could clean up the mess at Fukushima. It was called the DARPA Challenge. Many of the entries around the world, many of these individuals hoped to become famous for creating a robot that could clean up the mess at Fukushima. All he had to do was create a robot that could drive a car, a robot that could sweep the floor, turn a valve, clean up some simple debris, things that even a high school kid can do easily. Well, it turns out that almost all the entries failed because artificial intelligence is simply not yet developed to the point where it could do something as simple as clean up a mess at Fukushima because of the enormous radiation involved. Workers can only go in for seconds to minutes at a time, and they get perhaps a lethal amount of radiation if they stay too long in the Fukushima site. And what's made the situation even more complicated is that we don't even know what the configuration of the melted fuel looks like because we have not yet been successful in terms of sending robot submarines to photograph in three dimensions the exact nature of the melted fuel. What a mess. And so we're talking about billions and billions of dollars going down this rat hole. And speaking about science in the biotech front, a new advancement was made just last week. It turns out that we can now manipulate the genes, not just of healthy adults and also animals, but now the genes within an embryo. Now, why is that important? Because it opens the door to what is called germline gene therapy. Now, there are two kinds of genetic manipulations, germline and somatic. Somatic gene therapy basically changes the genes in your body so that you may be cured of a certain disease, but it doesn't go into your sperm or egg, and so your children could still come down with the same disease. However, germline gene therapy would eliminate that aberrant gene forever. Once and for all, it would eliminate that gene. Now, think about it for a moment. If you're Jewish, you have to worry about Tay-Sachs. If you're Northern European, you have to worry about cystic fibrosis. If you're African-American, you have to worry about sickle cell anemia. All of them created by one simple mutation in our genes. And so you may say to yourself, well, why not eliminate these lethal genes forever so that my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren are not going to suffer from the curse of these genetic diseases? Well, it sounds pretty good, right? And yes, In the short term, it does mean that genetic diseases which have haunted us since the beginning of time could eventually be eliminated. For example, in the royal families of Europe, because there's so much interbreeding, especially among the children of Queen Victoria, there's a gene for hemophilia, and other different kinds of mutant genes have circulated within the royal families of Europe, causing havoc in the histories of their nation. King George, for example, the king who ruled England during the time of the American Revolution, King George also suffered from a genetic disease which caused madness. So yeah, King George was mad, and that in turn probably helped to accelerate the American Revolution. Not to mention the hemophilia gene infected the Russian royal family, and as a consequence, Rasputin was able to gain enormous influence in the Tsarist family, delaying reforms, and some people think that helped to bring on the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. So yes, we have these genetic diseases, and why not eliminate them? Other people say, not so fast. Not so fast. Because what happens if this technology falls into the wrong hands? What happens if we begin to tinker with the genetic heritage of the human race? Or, as many people say, are we ready to play God? And so it is a problem. But again, it was a problem that was supposed to be far in the future, but now we can attain this kind of technology using a technology called CRISPR. CRISPR has changed the entire biomedical landscape just within the last few years. It's a way of precisely cutting DNA at a very specific points. We follow the lead of Mother Nature. Mother Nature, for billions of years, has created bacteria that have to fend off viruses. Yes, even bacteria have to worry about viruses. So within the bacteria, they have a template, or in some sense, a mugshot of the genes of killer viruses that once they invade the bacteria, they can now identify these genes and cut them and destroy them. Well, scientists have figured out how to use that mechanism that Mother Nature created billions of years ago and use it to cut very precisely the genes that we want to manipulate. So think about this, a new way to accelerate a process called gene therapy. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. And speaking about nuclear energy, in the second part of Exploration, we'd like to bring on an old friend of Exploration for the past 30 years, Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, who unfortunately passed away last year. And so we're going to talk about the Fukushima nuclear power plant accident. And of course, the cleanup operation hasn't changed much in the last few years at all. And we'd like to dedicate our comments to the memory of Michael Marriott, a friend of Exploration for the past 30 years, an expert on nuclear energy. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we gave a sum up as to what's happening on the sixth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster in Japan. But I'd like to, in the second half of Exploration, run an earlier tape that I did with Michael Marriott. Michael Marriott passed away last year. Unfortunately, he left his work unfinished. His work was to bring a halt to nuclear power, concentrating on the nuclear waste problem. He was the executive director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., which is one of the main clearinghouses of information concerning the fate of nuclear energy. And he was a friend of exploration for 30 years. Off and on, we had his voice on these airwaves giving us a sum up as to what's happening with nuclear energy. And so today, in his honor, I'd like to rerun an earlier tape and just remember that things really haven't changed much at Fukushima at all. We still have yet to begin a proper cleanup of the nuclear reactor. We have yet to even locate where the nuclear debris is concentrated at the bottom of the nuclear power plants. And we still have the radioactive water, which is accumulating at the rate of 400 tons per day on site. And so things really haven't changed much in 6 years. The main part of the cleanup, that is cleaning up the melted core, hasn't even begun yet. And it's going to be about 40 more agonizing years into the future before we finish that cleanup. And so once again, our special guest today is the late Michael Marriott, and we're going to be rerunning an earlier interview with him concerning the Fukushima disaster. Well, once again, our special guest today is Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. And today we're talking about nuclear energy. What's the status of the Fukushima disaster? What might have happened in the Philippines if there was a nuclear power plant within the gun sights of this gigantic, monstrous typhoon? And also global warming. Will nuclear energy save us from global warming? These are the questions we're going to be asking Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, one of the main clearinghouses concerning nuclear energy. Well, with us on the line is Michael Marriott of NIRS. So, Michael, first of all, tell us, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is the acronym for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization that was founded in 1978 to sort of help be the network center and sort of coordinating center for the what was then and is today a very decentralized grassroots movement for safe, clean energy and against nuclear power. And over the years, we've evolved. We now initiate campaigns, and our goal has expanded a little bit, too, in that we are working very hard to build the nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future that our planet both needs and deserves. You can find us at www.nirs.org.
Okay, so Michael, let's now talk about the Fukushima disaster, which is still ongoing. And first of all, tell us a little bit, sum up what exactly happened during the accident. And tell us about the state of the reactor today.
Well, back on March 11th, 2011, people across the world were woken up, at least those of us in the Western Hemisphere, with news that there had been a major earthquake off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami. And that was followed by a loss of electric power, not surprisingly, to a bunch of nuclear reactors, three of which at the Fukushima Daiichi locale, began melting down. The fourth didn't melt down because there was no fuel in the reactor at the time. And two other reactors at the site, which were separate, they were physically separated from the other four, experienced a number of problems, but ended up at least not melting down. So what we had was a scenario that I don't think anybody working in this field had ever envisioned. Three nuclear reactors melting down at the same time, coupled with severe problems at four reactor fuel storage pools, which were located at these sites. And we had a series of hydrogen explosions, which blew off the top of the reactor buildings, created all kinds of mess. And so now, approaching 3 years later, that's what we still have, three reactors that have melted down with the molten fuel somewhere underneath them. The authorities and the utility involved, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, they don't know exactly where that molten fuel is, too radioactive to try to get to, of course. And then we have, even though, this has happened, quite a long time ago, even though a lot of the fuel is still on the bottom of the, somewhere underneath the reactors, everything still needs to be kept cool. And so TEPCO built sort of a makeshift cooling system that runs through these reactors that leaks. And large amounts of water run through, become, through the various reactors, it becomes radioactive, it leaks into the groundwater, and rainwater from, obviously from rain. Fukushima is sort of at the bottom of a hill, rainwater comes down the hill, runs through the plant, it becomes radioactive. And pretty soon they notice that immense amounts of water are actually coming through that site, becoming radioactive and moving on into the nearby harbor.
So, Michael, the main worry there is that highly radioactive wastewater could then pour into the harbor and eventually affect China, Korea, and perhaps other Pacific nations. So what's known about how much radiation is actually flowing into the water, and how dangerous is that?
Well, it's not clear, at least to me, how much radiation we're talking about. We know how much water we're talking about. It's something like 400 million gallons a day flowing in there. The water, this is not, highly molten fuel going. So, the water's picking up radiation. So the radiation levels are not considered highly radioactive. But what happens is that there's a current that tends to keep the reactor, sort of a circular current in the harbor, and water tends to just sort of go around in a circle there, and the Japanese officials have used that as a nothing more than excuse, really, to argue that water and the radiation, in particular radiation, has not gone beyond the harbor. And of course, that's absolute nonsense. Water is going from there into the Pacific Ocean, probably not as much as some people think, but certainly a lot more than the Japanese government seems to think. Fish come into the harbor and swim back out again. They're not really deterred by this, circular current. The other forms of, sea life come in and out, and so it's very clear that, in fact, all of this, the radiation that has been coming down for the last couple of years and continues to come down is going out in the Pacific Ocean. And the question is, what are the impacts? What will be the impact? Pacific Ocean is a big place, and even this amount of water is pretty small compared in volume compared to the entire Pacific Ocean. But
now,
certainly an effect on seafood and other factors.
Now, the utility has suggested some rather unorthodox ways to contain all this rainwater. One is to build a wall of ice that is import lots of refrigerators to basically freeze the ground so that you build up an artificial barrier against all this rainwater, which is washing this radiation into the harbor. What are your thoughts about this? It's never been tried before on this kind of scale.
Right. Well, it was actually a process I'd never even heard of before, although I looked into it a bit, and it has been used as a blocking mechanism in a few places in the world, although, as you say, in a much smaller scale. I have yet to talk to somebody who thinks this is a good idea or who thinks it will work. But obviously, you know, when there's somebody willing to sell something, you know, somebody will buy it, I guess. I think this idea really is evidence, is more evidence that Tokyo Electric Power is in over its head. And, you know, this is a company, it's an electric utility. They made their money by selling electricity. This is not a major engineering firm, and I think that shows. And I think that's behind some of the recent efforts we've seen to, you know, bring some more international experience in to Fukushima to help out with this accident, because it's pretty clear that, you know, Tokyo Electric Power itself is floundering.
Now, some people have said that if there is another earthquake, it doesn't have to be a big one, even a minor earthquake, it could tip the reactor over. And the accident can start up all over again. So what are your thoughts about the fact that earthquakes happen all the time in Japan, and it wouldn't take much to tip this reactor over? What are your thoughts?
Right. Well, I'm assuming you're talking about the Unit 4 reactor there, which was the explosion. They hit that reactor, sort of crippled the building, sort of put it at a slant. I mean, you know, all the reactors there are in pretty bad shape, and if you want to talk about, you know, which reactor, you know, we still believe is the most dangerous, it's Unit 3, but Unit 4 has gotten the most attention. And they have put some effort into bolstering that the structure of that reactor. They've had to do that for two reasons. One is that obviously the building was in very sorry shape and you know, noticeably leaning. Two is that they decided that that's the building because that building had not experienced a meltdown. There had been no fuel in the reactor core itself. That would be the starting point for cleanup. And so this month is when they're planning to begin removing the fuel from the fuel pool in that building. So they had to bolster it up quite a bit. They claim, they meaning the utility and Japanese authorities, claim that it could withstand at least a direct 6.0 earthquake. But I don't know if they're right or not, and I hope we don't find out. But, you know, as you say, you know, this is an earthquake-prone place. And I think it is better to get the fuel out of this building as soon as safely possible, you know, before the next one hits. Because in Japan, you're sort of always waiting for the next one to hit.
Right. In fact, just recently, there was a 5.5 earthquake that rattled Tokyo. Quite a few people were shaken out of bed, in fact. It was so great. And that was just right outside Tokyo. Now, some people say, well, why don't they simply send in workers and robots and just get rid of this melted core, and why don't they just repair the whole operation? But tell us about the conditions that the workers have to work in, given the fact that it's highly radioactive, and robots have proven to be a huge disappointment.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, these are unprecedented conditions. I mean, we've never tried... You know, at Chernobyl, which was the major nuclear accident before this one, 1986, it exploded. The Soviet Union at the time, I mean, there were 600,000 people. They became liquidators, and their job was to run up. They could stand up for about 15 seconds and take, you know, and move some debris. 600,000 people, and they have been exposed to a very high risk of cancer. A lot of them have died from it since. At Fukushima, you know, they don't have liquidators. They have utility employees and contractors and subcontractors. But yet the conditions, the radiation levels where the core is, where the, underneath the building, are just as comparable as Chernobyl. In some ways, it's probably harder because you've got, as we said, we had three simultaneous meltdowns. We've got three reactor cores that cannot be approached by people. And you can't even get to the core in a protective suit. I mean, you have to be away from it. And meanwhile, you have so much debris throughout what's left of these buildings that the robots they sent in, find it really difficult to maneuver around. I mean, they did get some in. I've seen some photos of inside the buildings, and some of the floors actually surprisingly look almost normal, but they try to get anywhere near where the fuel is, and they're blocked, and the cameras go bad, the radiation levels, the radiation film, of course, doesn't work well together. So it's a monumental, unprecedented task, and it's going to take decades before this is.
In fact,
this story is over.
The official estimate is 40 years. 40 years, an estimate made by the utility itself. So we're going to be agonizing about this for decades and decades to come, right? Our grandkids are going to be learning about the cleanup operation.
Well, that's right, and I think 40 years may be optimistic. But when you look at the reality is we're almost 3 years out. They are just beginning this month to begin removing the first fuel rod from the first pool. That removal of the fuel rods from that pool, if all goes well, scheduled to take a year and a half. We got three more fuel pools after that, one of which at Unit 3 is in a much worse condition. And then we got these reactor cores after that. And as I said, they don't even know exactly where the fuel is. And that's going to be extraordinarily highly radioactive for, decades, centuries, really.
Okay.
So, this process, this is going to be with us the rest of our lives.
Okay, well, change the subject a little bit. Some people claim that no matter how bad nuclear is, there's something worse, and that is global warming. In fact, Dr. James Hansen, who's one of the leading figures pushing the global warming theory, has pretty much said that, perhaps the white knight could be nuclear power. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Dr. Hansen, along with three of his colleagues, recently wrote an open letter, what he called an open letter to environmentalists, urging us to reconsider and support new nuclear power as a means of addressing climate change. And Dr. Hansen is an esteemed climate scientist. The entire world owes him a debt of gratitude for his work on climate, and especially in effectively warning that we have to do something about climate. But climate and energy are two different issues. They're two different areas of expertise. And unfortunately, Dr. Hansen's expertise doesn't seem to extend to energy. Nuclear power is not a solution to climate change. It never has been. Even if nuclear power were safe, let's take the safety issue off the table for a moment. Even if nuclear power didn't create radioactive waste, we'll take that issue off the table for a moment. The reality is we couldn't build enough nuclear power plants to play any kind of meaningful role in addressing climate change in any kind of time period that would matter. And that's what's so puzzling about his argument. He wants us to build a lot of nuclear reactors between, and by a lot, I mean an astonishing amount, well more than has ever been contemplated, over the next 20 years. And what we're seeing in reality is the collapse of the nuclear power industry in the U.S. We're not seeing new reactors. We're seeing new reactor projects abandoned. In fact, just yesterday in Texas, two more proposed new reactors that were supposed to be part of this nuclear renaissance that was supposed to begin, around 2008, 2009. Two more reactors in north central Texas were canceled. The nuclear renaissance, at one point, there were plans to build more than 30 new reactors in this country starting this decade. We're down to four. And the utilities are realizing that they don't want nuclear power. They can't afford nuclear power. On an economic basis, nuclear power can no longer compete. And we're seeing that not only with new plants, which we knew were extraordinarily expensive, but even operating plants. In 2013 alone, we've had five reactor shutdowns of operating reactors. That's unprecedented. We've never had that in one year before. And we believe, NIRS believe, and a lot of other people believe, in fact, even Forbes magazine last week had an article on this, this is a trend that's going to accelerate. We're going to see more reactor shutdowns next year and the year after that. The nuclear industry is getting smaller, not bigger. Now, Dr. Hansen espouses new types of reactors, generally something called small modular reactors and integral fast reactors. These are reactors that exist on paper and in laboratories. They don't actually exist in the real world. There's never been a full-scale prototype built. And the idea that we are somehow going to take these reactor designs that exist on paper and in somebody's lab and build hundreds, if not thousands of them before the mid-century, when we have competing fuels that are much, much cheaper and just as clean, if not cleaner, than nuclear power, just makes no sense. And by just as clean or cleaner, I'm talking about solar and wind.
Okay, now, Michael, given the fact that well-known individuals are now jumping into the fray, Bill Gates recently jumped into this debate as well, talking about backyard nuclear power plants. Instead of having a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage, he wants to have a nuclear power plant in everyone's backyard. So explain the logic behind backyard nukes.
Well, the belief is, Bill Gates, this is another version of the small modular reactor. The idea behind them is that if you make them relatively small, and of course, they are much bigger than backyard, but if you make relatively small and you can make them modular, meaning that they can be cranked out in a factory instead of fully custom built at a site, that maybe you can make them cheaper. But the problem is the reason reactors got so large to begin with was, the well-known phrase, economies of scale. The early reactors built in this country and everywhere else were very small. And the utilities quickly realized that they couldn't build them small and economically, so they ramped up the size. The same factor seems like it's going to hold true now. And I say seems like because, again, these reactors don't actually exist. They're dreams on paper. And they're also too late because when we want to talk about backyard power sources, well, we have them. It's called rooftop solar. And there's a rooftop solar system being installed in this country every 4 minutes now, 2013. In 2 years, that's going to be every 90 seconds. We're going to have a new rooftop solar unit going up in this country.
Well, Michael, these so-called backyard nuclear power plants have gotten a certain amount of publicity. So let us now elaborate on this. So tell us a little bit about the history of this. And there's a certain person called David Crane, head of one of the largest utilities, Energy. Tell us about his position.
David Crane is ahead of it. And you know, David Crane is not some anti-nuclear advocate. In fact, we've been fighting a proposed nuclear plant in Texas, a different one in Texas, that he initiated. Now, he got out of the plant. He got energy out of the project immediately after Fukushima. That ended nuclear power for him. But he recently said, he recently told Business Week magazine that distributed energy generation, and by distributed energy generation, we actually mean backyard power, rooftop solar, solar on top of, you know, Walmart warehouses and that kind of thing, small wind farms, even a backyard wind turbine, that is going to, in the same way, this is what Crane told Business Week, in the same way that cell phone use overtook landline use, distributed generation is going to overtake the current and traditional utility model of big baseload generation coming from dozens or hundreds of miles away, bringing power into your home. In the same way and in the same kind of time frame, this is going to happen. Now, if you think about that time frame, it's less than 20 years. Our electric system model is going to be completely different, and we are going to be relying far more on rooftop solar, on wind, on other types of renewables that can be done locally and nearby. And you know, not that the big power plants are ever going to go away, but they're going to play the subsidiary role. They're not going to play the major role anymore.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And we ran a broadcast that we previously recorded with Michael Marriott, Executive Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, who passed away last year. So unfortunately, we're going to be dedicating our comments today in the memory of Michael Marriott, who for the past 30 years has been a friend of Exploration. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.